I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the new Supreme Court docket, which includes a question of whether lawyers can play the O.J. card, refer to him in cases that don't involve him. Also, did you know Congress can and has changed the size of the court? We'll have all that. But first, the deteriorating situation in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, where protests against the military government continued for the 10th straight day today. There are reports of several deaths and soldiers firing shots and tear gas into crowds of tens of thousands of demonstrators. Monasteries were raided overnight, dozens of monks arrested and beaten, images of the chaos transmitted by dissidents using cell phones and the internet. Simon Montlake is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's in Bangkok. Simon, what's the latest you're hearing about the crackdown?
Well, by now it's nighttime and the curfew is in place, so I think a lot of people are getting off the streets now. There's a lot of angry feeling about what happened today, and I think that the soldiers are just going to increase their presence. I think the nighttime is a particularly sensitive time because people know that soldiers could just come driving down the streets and fire on them and no one would see it. So everyone's trying to get off the streets at night, but we're expecting it to resume again on Friday.
We're reading that some of the Buddhist monks have been killed, the monks, of course, spearheading this protest, which started as a protest against rising fuel prices, but of course it was about so much more than that. What is the sense of there being a reaction to monks being killed? You know, people maybe joining the protest who weren't involved initially.
Yeah, there's a lot of shock, frustration, anger amongst ordinary people. And some of the activist groups I've spoke to and some of the foreigners in Yangon say, you know, the atmosphere is really starting to change quite a lot. People are angry about that. But people who are actually out on the streets, and today in particular, it was very much a student crowd, a young crowd. So, yes, they're fired up by anger. And it's much more than just whether the monks have been attacked and how unrespectful that is. I mean, this is sort of pent-up anger, which is spilling out now. More people are almost spoiling for a fight. They're just expecting this to turn bloody, and that's what we've been seeing.
Well, this is the largest uprising against the military junta since the failed uprising in 1988. So many were killed then. Are these the children of those protesters?
In some cases, we actually know that some of the organizers particularly behind the early protesters are the so-called Generation of 88. There were student leaders who were jailed, arrested, detained after that. And some spent several years, if not a decade, in prison, came out and then started to rebuild networks and to see ways of sort of fighting back. And what we're seeing now, I think, is some of those people are behind the protest. But at the same time, yes, there are much younger people who are out there and involved. Everyone seems to be ready to come out and watch, if not join in.
Well, China issued a statement yesterday calling on Myanmar to exercise restraint, the government. But yesterday, China blocked a UN Security Council motion to condemn the government crackdown. China, we know, is a huge backer of Myanmar. And China, as we know, also has its eye on the Olympics in Beijing in 2008. Couldn't possibly want this to become even more of a disaster. What do you think is ahead?
Well, I think China's position might be more nuanced than we're seeing on the surface. I mean, clearly they do have a lot of stake here. They don't want to see Myanmar teeter over into complete chaos. There's also, you've got to remember, actually quite a sizable Chinese business community and people who have moved there from China. And they would be very vulnerable in any situation where the regime falls or starts to lose control. I mean, they would be first in line for reprisals, I think. I mean, if you're running a Chinese business. I mean, there's already been some marches which have gone past the Chinese embassy. And so I think China is playing maybe a more nuanced game than we know in terms of trying to nudge the regime to sort of find some way forward which doesn't devolve into complete bloodshed. But at the same time, this is a country which is the biggest supplier of arms to the military in Burma. So quite clearly, whatever happens does ricochet back to the leadership in Beijing.
And one last question, Simon. Do we know what's happened to Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Prize winner who's been under house arrest and who is supported by these demonstrators?
We saw her very briefly on Saturday. A group of monks actually went down her street. She came to the door, and that was her first public appearance in 4 years. Something that gave hope to people in terms of this being a kind of figure who can unite the oppositions. But now I suspect that we won't see much of her, and people might be concerned about what will happen to her next, because she may well hold the key to any sort of peaceful compromise that comes out of this unrest.
Simon Montlake, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Bangkok about the protests across the border in Myanmar. Simon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And to read Simon's reporting in the Monitor today with more on the background of the protests, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, today we have two conversations about the Supreme Court. Did you know that Congress, if it wanted, could change the number of justices, say, hypothetically, give a new Democratic president the right to change the current balance on the court by adding more justices? But we start with the current court and the docket for the new term, which begins next week. The list includes detainees, the definition of child pornography. Just this week, the court added a few more cases, including a fight over requiring photo IDs at the voting booth in Indiana. The state says it will help them fight fraud. Critics say it will make it harder for the poor who tend to vote with Democrats to vote at all. And the justices also agreed this week to consider whether the chemical combination many states use in death row lethal injections amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. Well, here with a preview, here and now, Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston, who also covers the High Court for SCOTUSblog.com. Welcome, Lyle, as always.
Robin, I'm glad to be back with you for another term.
And tell us, what do you think this term is going to be the case that's going to have the greatest, you know, watershed effect? We're guessing it might be the Gitmo Bay case.
Well, I would agree wholeheartedly with you on that, Robin, because this is the court's fourth look at the rights of detainees. It's been interesting that the court has defined the powers of the presidency and Congress and the courts mostly and perhaps even entirely in the context of, do the detainees at Guantanamo have any legal rights? Mm. So once more, they're coming back to the issue, and this is a really fundamental fight over whether those folks down there have any legal rights at all.
What's the exact question before the court?
The exact question is whether Congress can, as it did, take away the rights of detainees to bring legal complaints in our federal courts to challenge their detention.
Right. Well, in addition, the justices are going to once again wrestle with the question of child pornography. At issue in this case, we understand, the definition of pandering in a law aimed at stopping Internet child porn. We understand one of the cases is a man who sent emailed pictures, and he's, you know, saying he had the right to do that.
Yes, this gentleman has complained that his right of free speech has been violated because the definition for pandering, which is in the law, is too loose, too broad, and it captures too many people who are not actually engaging in child pornography.
The example is given of, you know, grandparents who might be arrested for sending, you know, an email of their grandchildren saying great pictures of the kids.
Yeah, this has been the problem, Robin, all along with Congress's efforts in this area, because Congress writes it in a broad way to try to capture a lot of people, but in the process, the courts have said it winds up capturing a lot of innocents as well.
Well, the court is also going to examine the limits of presidential power in the case of a Mexican citizen on death row in Texas. This is the second time the case of Jorge Medellin has come before the court. What issue does the case center around this time?
Well, this time the case turns solely on the question of whether the President of the United States can tell states that they must change their criminal law procedures when that is necessary to satisfy a treaty or a decision of the World Court. So it involves a major question of presidential power. President Bush has essentially told the state of Texas these Mexican nationals, including Jose Medellin, were denied their rights under a consular treaty, and those rights have to be observed, even though it's a violation of Texas law to give them those rights. So it's a big contest.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because of course, critics of the president would say that he's not applying the same thinking to the detainees at Gitmo.
Well, I think that's an analogy or a comparison that could easily be drawn. As a matter of fact, the president in this very case said, I don't agree with what the World Court did, but as president, I must enforce its judgments, and the states have to go along.
Okay, Lyle, the lightning round. One of the cases has been called the most important securities case in a generation. It centers on whether shareholders can sue a company's banks, lawyers, and other third parties if they played a role in fraud. And, of course, the question is, will a ruling by the Supreme Court in this case help determine who's to blame for the Enron scandal?
Well, the court is taking on an issue that is of great interest to not only to Wall Street, but to lawyers who advise corporations, because these third parties, like banks, investment banks, lawyers, accountants, didn't themselves violate the federal securities laws, but they helped out when those clients committed securities fraud. And, of course, these are people who have much deeper pockets than some of the people who did violate securities laws, and investors want to go after those deep pockets. And so the outcome of this case, its most important immediate impact will be on a case involving the Enron scandal, where some of the nation's biggest investment houses, like Merrill Lynch, face the prospect of being tagged with $40 billion in damage claims.
Well, there's also a case about sentencing in crack cocaine cases. Black men get much more jail time for possessing crack cocaine than whites do for powdered cocaine. But race also comes up in another case. It involves, you know, invoking O.J. Simpson's story in court. Briefly tell us the question there.
Well, this is a case involving a man in suburban New Orleans who killed his former girlfriend's new boyfriend. And he's black, and the prosecutor, using the tactics that jury selection allows, apparently struck all the potential black jurors, winding up with an all-white jury. So the man was convicted by this all-white jury, and then in trying to get the death sentence, the prosecutor said, I want you to think about one of the most famous murder trials in history. It was out in California. You all know what I'm talking about. And there, a man got away with it after pretending that he was going to commit suicide, and that's what happened in this case. The argument is that the playing of the O.J. card, as it's called, is an attempt to use race to influence a jury to impose the death sentence on a black man. And, of course, in this case, if that's exactly what was done, that did have the effect that the jury came back with a death sentence.
Is there anything, Lyle, that you want to mention that you're keeping your eye on as the Supreme Court session starts?
Yes, Robin. I'm watching a big case from the District of Columbia, which would put before the court for the first time since 1939 the whole question of what the Second Amendment means, that people have a right to keep and bear arms. The question that's raised by the District of Columbia is whether that gives you a personal right to have a gun for your own use and you can keep it in your home, or whether it's a right that only, let's say, someone in the National Guard has. And it's a case that it appears the Supreme Court will agree to hear, because both sides say take the case. And the outcome of this case is going to define exactly what the Second Amendment means. And that's an issue that has been open for more than the last seven decades.
Oh, that's going to be fascinating. Well, that's Here and Now Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston, who also covers the High Court for SCOTUSblog.com. And again, the Supreme Court opens its new term next week. Well, did you know, and maybe you did, that historically Congress has changed the number of justices on the court, stacked the court to uphold laws? Should it happen now? Also, later, our favorite Miles Davis tune. Back after a minute break, Here and Now. We've been hearing today about the Supreme Court, which begins its new term next week. Supreme Court justices are appointed for life. The oldest, John Paul Stevens, is 87. Seven of the current nine justices, including Stevens, were appointed by Republican presidents. And as everyone knows, there are always nine sitting justices. Well, wait a minute. Originally, the number was six. It's gone down to five, though, and up to 10. The size of the court is not fixed by the Constitution. It's set by Congress. And did you know Supreme Court justices can be impeached? One was, or tried, in the 1800s. He was impeached or tried for being too political. He held on to his job but changed his ways. Joining us now, Jean Edward Smith, professor of political science at Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia, and author most recently of the biography FDR. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And you wrote about all of this in an op-ed piece in the New York Times this summer that caught our eye. You say Republicans and Democrats have used congressional power to change the court. Take us through history. Start with the very first time. The court was set at six in 1789, then changed in 1800. Tell us what happened.
The Judiciary Act of 1789 fixed the number at six. When the Federalists lost the election of 1800 to Mr. Jefferson, the outgoing Federalist Congress reduced the size of the court to five, hoping to prevent Mr. Jefferson from having an appointment. As soon as the Jeffersonian Congress took office, they repealed that act, leaving the number at six, and then in 1807 increased the number to seven to give Jefferson an additional appointment.
And this was all, you know, under the law?
Oh, yes. Article 3 of the Constitution does not fix the size of the court. It leaves that to Congress.
Right.
During the administration of Andrew Jackson, the Democrats increased the size of the court to nine to give Jackson two additional appointments. And it stayed at nine until the Civil War, when to ensure that there would be a pro-union, anti-slavery majority on the court, the number was raised to 10. And when Lincoln was shot and Andrew Johnson, who was a Democrat, took office, the Republican Congress reduced the size of the court to seven to ensure that Johnson would not have an appointment.
The Civil War is so interesting. I mean, all the way up to 10. Again, the court literally stacked to ensure that they would not be ruling for slavery.
Well, that's right, and that's why it was increased to 10. But I think the best example is when it was seven under Andrew Johnson, when Grant became president, the Republicans increased the size of the court to nine, and the two new justices voted with the Grant administration to reverse an earlier decision to make greenbacks constitutional.
And when was the last time that the court was either changed or an attempt was made to change the number on the
court? Well, that was in 1937, President Roosevelt. And President Roosevelt was greedy. Instead of accepting a change of one or two justices, as had been the pattern, Roosevelt's plan would have given the president six additional appointments, and that was simply too much for the tradition to bear.
But he couched it, he masked it. His proposal was that there be new justices added because the old justices needed help.
Well, that's right, and it was too clever by half. Roosevelt tried to conceal what he was doing by suggesting that for every justice who reached the age of, and actually it was for all federal judges who reached the age of 70, and did not retire within 6 months, the president would be given an additional appointment. Six of the justices on the Hughes Court were 70 years or older, and that would have given FDR six additional appointments.
Well, and his claim that the justices weren't able to keep up with the load just wasn't true.
That was hogwash. And Chief Justice Hughes wrote a famous memorandum in which he demonstrated conclusively that the court was not only abreast of its workload, but was handling more cases than had been done by any court in the century.
Hmm. Well, you wrote your op-ed piece as a warning to the current Roberts Court. You say justices should stick to legal issues. This court is thumbing its nose at popular values. As you know, there was a huge response in the letter section to your column. And the criticism was, wait a minute, it's just that you don't like what this court is doing. It's not your, you know, the opinions aren't going your way. Do they have a point?
Well, every time the number of the court has been changed, it's because Congress was concerned that the decisions weren't going their way.
So it's always political and unabashedly
absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
Because I was thinking, you know, the same argument could have been made at other times in history. For instance, popular opinion was against civil rights. So
I think Roosevelt gave court packing a bad name. To ask for six additional justices made everyone turn it thumbs down, and it really gave a sanctity to the number nine, which had not existed previously.
So you're saying that a little tweaking by the Congress in power is not a bad thing?
That's absolutely correct, especially when the court becomes so blatantly political, as one could argue the Roberts Court has, and really is using its position to decide issues that are manifestly political.
Right. Well, there's another debate going on, and this was reflected in the letters as well, that justices shouldn't have life appointments.
Many in the legal profession, the political science profession, have raised that issue. The problem with that, however, is that Article 3 of the Constitution really indicates that federal judges have lifetime tenure, and it would probably require a constitutional amendment to make that change. Changing the number is a much easier way to go about it.
To change the number on the court in the direction you'd like to see it changed would take a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress.
Well, yes, because the president could veto the congressional legislation if he didn't like it.
Do you worry that would backfire? Is it possible that, you know, there's a sense that the institutions of government are more fixed now?
Well, it depends really on how blatantly political the Roberts Court would become. If it became excessively political, and if those decisions ran contrary to significant public opinion, I don't see that it would be objected to. On the other hand, if there is a move in Congress or in popular opinion to change the number of the court, it's quite likely that the Roberts Court itself would take a more cautious position.
Jean Edward Smith, professor of political science at Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia, author most recently of FDR. Professor Smith, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
A look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. Presidential politics. Who's in front? Does it matter at this stage of the game? Are any candidates positioning themselves to be running mates? Also, we attend a meeting of the Jane Austen Society as Janapalooza breaks out. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, alternative energy in California. New homes with solar energy are selling faster than traditional homes. Also, if you have trouble parallel parking, could a foldable car be in your future? That's all after the news, Here and Now. After skipping the UN climate summit held in New York on Monday, President Bush is hosting his own climate meetings in Washington today and tomorrow, with India and China among the 16 invited guests. The president believes emission cuts should be voluntary rather than government mandated. Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger of California does not agree. He told UN delegates this week that states like his are putting in place emission caps, even if the Bush administration isn't. California is also leading the nation in solar power, accounting for 70% of all solar panel installations in the country. And in some cities there, solar-powered homes are outselling traditional homes. Well, this week, California is hosting Solar Power 2007. That's where Julia Judd Hamm is. She's executive director of the Solar Electric Power Association. Julia, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
How many people do you have at this big solar expo this week?
Just about 13,000 people total, and we're seeing significant growth each year.
Well, why is that, do you think? I mean, is it just people getting familiar with it? Have costs come down? What's the draw?
We have to recognize that it definitely is just a general increased consumer awareness or general public awareness about what's happening with climate change. You know, a rooftop application for homes, it's one relatively easy way for people to actually make a pretty significant difference. One thing I think, you know, I want to point out to listeners is that people typically think about the panels, you know, big solar panels on your roof when they think about solar. What the manufacturers of this technology are now doing is actually almost all of them have available solar roof shingles. So instead of putting big panels on your roof, what's happening is they're actually, you can replace your roof shingles with small individual solar roofing shingles. The color's slightly different in most cases, but it fits right into your roof. And really, unless you pointed it out to your neighbor walking by, they probably wouldn't even notice that it's there.
Well, but the questions that people have always had about solar still seem to stand, and they are about cost and the availability of the sun. So let's start with cost. In California, where we said the state offers incentives to use solar technology, how much on average does it cost to put solar panels on a home, and how long does it take to, you know, make that money back?
Sure. Well, in California, the total cost for the equipment and the installation labor typically is about $25,000. But once you take into account both the state incentives that are available through the local utilities and there is a federal investment tax credit as well, the actual out-of-pocket expense, ballpark around $15,000.
Now, when you mention the federal rebate, is that EPACT?
It is.
So EPACT is about a $2,000 federal credit.
Exactly.
Well, but we went online and did one of these solar calculators. We're in Boston, of course, but we put in a $125 a month electric bill, and it came out that it would be about a $72,000 installation, $62,000 after Massachusetts credits and rebates, and it would take 10 to 27 years to break even.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with infrastructure development. The market in California is much more mature. So because so much more solar has been installed, there's obviously much more competition in the marketplace. The installers are much more experienced. You know, obviously, it's just a scale issue. And what we're seeing in California is that homes that have solar installed on them compared to homes just like them without solar are selling for between, let's $20,000 to $30,000 more.
And if you don't sell, how much how long does it take you to recoup, you know, on energy savings?
You're probably talking between 6 and 8 years.
Is it far less expensive to build a new facility or house with solar than to install solar?
When you're doing, you know, a larger scale installation of multiple homes at once, it really does help drive down the cost.
We mentioned the Million Solar Roofs initiative in California. It speaks to the sort of the infrastructure for getting this done. By the way, what about the availability of sun? You know, people feel that, well, I don't live in California. You're awfully sunny there, so that's why solar works there, but it may not work elsewhere.
Yeah, you know, it's true that it does work better in some places than others, but it generally is a misperception that you have to be in a place that has great sun all the time to make solar a good decision for you. The largest solar market in the entire world is Germany, because they have a great policy structure in place.
And you don't find yourself saying, oh, sunny Germany.
Exactly. You know, when you look at the, you know, the solar resource map of the world, the quality of the sunlight they get, Germany is actually the equivalent in the U.S. to Anchorage, Alaska, and everywhere else in the U.S. is actually significantly better than Germany.
Well, a couple other concerns about solar energy, that solar panels are usually made of silicon. That's also used to make computer chips.
Sure.
And we understand there have been silicon shortages in the past couple of years, and computer industry and solar industry competing for that remaining silicon.
Yeah, well, but the industry is responding. Plants are being built right now, and we're expecting those to come online within the next 12 to 24 months.
So you don't see a silicon shortage or a shortage driving up the cost even more?
Over the past 2 years, the cost did rise slightly, actually, because of the shortage. But in every area now, the cost is actually going back down again, and it will just continue to go down as the new production comes online.
If you do have solar energy and you make more than you need, can you sell it? Can you sell excess energy back to the electric grid?
The rules on that, again, just like the incentives that are available, unfortunately, are very different from state to state. So what you're referring to is called net metering. There are dozens of states that do have net metering policies in place. So, for example, in California, what happens is the electric utility, at the end of the year, will look at how much power the system on your roof produced and then compare that to how much your home used. And if you produced more than you used, your bill will be zero. However, they will not pay you for any excess. In some other states, if you produce excess, they actually will cut you a check for that difference.
We understand as well that major utility companies in California are going to build solar facilities.
Yes. It's not just California. I don't know if people have seen the news yet, but actually FPL, Florida Power and Light, actually just yesterday announced a $2.4 billion investment in solar. It's great to see solar developing on two different tracks. You know, we've got the rooftop systems on individual homes and businesses, and at the same time, utilities now really stepping up to the plate to use solar in the large scale power production plants.
So, you know, if it's, you know, really gaining, if utility companies are taking it on, you know, people who really have an eye on the bottom line, why isn't it taking it off? Why don't we all have it? Why don't all new homes have it?
The industry is growing at 30 to 40% per year. And honestly, an industry can't grow a whole lot faster than that. It takes a long time to scale up. They need to build new plants. They need to, you know, we need to get the infrastructure, build the capacity so that we can do it in a sustainable way.
But do we understand, though, that solar power has a certain threshold, that there, you know, it's never, we're never going to be entirely fueled by solar power? It just wouldn't be possible.
Well, yeah. You know, actually, we had a really great CEO panel at our conference yesterday. What they brought to everyone's attention, and I think it's a critical point, is that it will take a long time to make a big dent in total energy production. What we can do is make a huge dent in the incremental new energy production. Solar could easily become from 10% up to 70% of all new energy production.
Julia Dudham, Executive Director of the Solar Electric Power Association, speaking to us about the growth in the solar energy industry from the Solar Power 2007 conference in Long Beach this week. Julia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, a question for you. If you could put one, just one, Miles Davis tune on your iPod, what would it be? We've got about 5 minutes till we tell you ours. You're listening to Here and Now. American architect Louis Kahn thought cars were a menace to urban life, so his 1950s vision of the urban landscape kept cars out, with highways and parking garages surrounding city centers like walls around a medieval town. Well, a quick look at today's city shows that his idea didn't exactly take root. There are cars, trucks, and buses everywhere, jamming into parallel parking spaces in Center City, Philly, fighting pedestrians near the Boston Common. Now researchers at MIT have a plan to ease the congestion and parking problems that plague cities, and believe it or not, their solution is a car. Here and now intern Jill Ryan takes a look.
The MIT Media Lab has a humble location in the basement of a nondescript beige building in the heart of the Cambridge campus. Behind a glass door labeled Lifelong Kindergarten, bins of Legos line one of the lab's walls. They're for the researchers to play with, not the kids.
Did I turn this? Oh, you need to plug in that.
In the entrance hall outside the lab, PhD students Ryan Chin and Raul David Poblano hunch over a large gray wheel. It's an oversized model of one of the four wheels that may eventually power MIT's car of the future. Chin says it's called the City Car.
What you're looking at is a mock-up of what we call the wheel robot. We built this just to test out the maneuverability of just one wheel, and then we wanted to apply it to the entire car.
What you're hearing right now is actually the wheel scrubbing against the linoleum floor. And basically, I'm rotating it to the right, 360, and now I'm going to drive forward.
When it's finished, the wheel robot, as Chin calls it, will be about the size of an extra-large pizza, and it'll contain everything that makes the car go, including mini electric motors and steering and suspension mechanisms. And the wheels will rotate up to 150 degrees, so to parallel park, you'll just drive sideways. By putting all the car's vital parts in the wheels, there'll be next to nothing in the chassis, except for a couple of seats, maybe a computer monitor, and a joystick to control the car. So the car will be light, so light it can even be stacked. Professor Bill Mitchell heads the project. These stackable cars gave him an idea.
So the basic idea is a small electric car that folds and stacks like shopping carts or like the luggage carts at the airport. They recharge while they're in the stacks, so they don't need a lot of range and they don't need to carry a lot of batteries around. It's a little bit like having valet parking everywhere. You just have stacks of these things around the city.
With a swipe of their credit cards, Mitchell says drivers can pick up a city car, travel to their destination, and drop the vehicle off at any number of stacking stations scattered around the city. With people sharing like this, Ryan Chin says there will be fewer vehicles to clog the streets.
Most of the congestion is caused by private automobiles right now. And a private automobile is typically only used about 5 to 10% during the day. So if you get people to share vehicles and get usage of 6, 7, or 8 times a day, you're going to reduce the amount of vehicles that are on the road. So by doing that, you're going to reduce congestion.
And because the cars can fold to half their size, spaces previously reserved for parking will become available for other uses.
We can replace it with trees. We'll replace it with green. We'll replace it with parks.
Chin and Mitchell say these dramatic changes will take place gradually. They have sponsorship from General Motors, and if all goes well, their city car could be humming along streets in as little as 3 years. And Chin says that could mean changes for suburbs, too.
The impact, at least in the United States, is that there will be a kind of movement back into the city. If you can provide the amenities in the city that make it much more livable, then perhaps less people will want to live out there.
In the suburbs, that is. And Chin says there's another unique feature of the car. Drivers can instantly personalize the vehicle. They can adjust seats with a swipe of an ID card. They can also download their maps, calendars, addresses, and music into the car's computer. Drivers can even adjust the way the car handles, choosing to zip around corners and stop on a dime like a race car, or...
Or if I want to drive sedately like my grandmother would.
Here and now intern Jill Ryan at MIT. You can learn more about MIT's city car by going to our website, here-now.org. Coming up, remembering Miles Davis, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Miles Davis, said to be one of the most relentlessly creative musicians of the 20th century, died 16 years ago tomorrow in Santa Monica at the age of 65. In the 40s, he was a teenage sideman with Charlie Parker. He electrified jazz in the 60s with what came to be called fusion. And before he died, Miles Davis had recorded dozens of songs that redefined improvisational music. So, what's your favorite? Well, that's a question we asked Here Now jazz aficionado James Isaacs on what would have been Miles' 80th birthday. Tomorrow's benchmark gives us a chance to bring you again his response, one of our favorite stories. We're hearing what you say you might pick as one of your favorite Miles Davis performances. I mean, it would be up there with, I'm sure, many more, because how could you pick just one?
There are about, let's say, 500 candidates, individual titles over the years.
Right.
Way back in the last century, Robin, when I was an all-night jazz DJ on a small Boston station, one of my dozens of listeners called one night to ask, James, what's your single favorite, all-time favorite Miles Davis track? And I gave him this answer with very little hesitation. Someday my prince will come.
Okay, so we're going to spend some time with Someday My Prince Will Come, a wonderful way to spend some time. And let's remind people, many people already know, this was originally a song from Walt Disney's Snow White. It's the animated film. And who can forget, I can see her now, Snow, if I may call her Snow.
Quite all right with me.
Singing to the bluebirds, you know, as the dwarfs watched and swooned. Let's listen to a little bit of the original.
Someday my prince will come. Someday we'll meet again. And away to his castle we'll go.
No vibrato there.
Not too much, you know, like a truck could drive through.
That's right. But, I mean, you just, I mean, people swooned when they heard this song. Remind us, who wrote the song?
The team of Larry Morey and Frank Churchill. They were Disney staff writers. And by the way, that voice belonged to Adriana Casalotti, who was 18 years old at the time.
Yeah. Now, this song you would not think immediately, you know, thinking of the movie, you wouldn't immediately think jazz vehicle.
No.
So what do you think it was about Someday My Prince Will Come that attracted a jazz player?
Well, Robin, it is a sweet little song. And at the time that this was recorded by Miles Davis, 1961, jazz waltzes were becoming very fashionable, and this is one of them.
And when did it become significant for you? I mean, what was it like when you first heard it?
Well, you know, I'm 15 years old. I'm this romantic kid in the suburbs, you know, and it knocked me out. I thought it was fantastic. You know, the thing is, Robin, when music is great, it transports you, but sometimes you transport it. And again, I guess that's my very romantic 15-year-old self way of saying that this piece of music eventually did transport me, and my life at the time transported it, so that I started making these really personal connections to the soloists.
Oh, well, let's do that then. What we're going to do is we're going to deconstruct Someday My Prince Will Come as a romantic 15-year-old James heard it. Let's go through the solos one by one.
After a while, you get to learn these solos by heart, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I started to give personalities to each of the soloists in the Miles Davis Sextet of 1961. So we start with Miles. And, of course, it's well known that he was a very urbane and sophisticated guy. I thought of him as, you know, this kind of reticent suitor, you know. Now, you listen to the way that he uses space here, you know, and by space I mean the way that he uses rests in the tune. When I hear this, I think of Miles Davis saying, well, you know, I could be in love with this person. Maybe I love you, but, you know, I'm digging myself, too. And if I do manage to wake you up from your slumber, make sure you're well-dressed.
Who's up after Miles?
The middleweight champion of the tenor saxophone, Hank Mobley, and that's not my championship title term for him. It's, I think, Ira Gittler, jazz critic. When I hear Hank Mobley, I think of kind of a country guy. He's slightly shy, maybe even a little fumbling as a suitor. But he's charming. You know, he's got stuff to say, and he'd be a nice guy for Snow White to be with.
But he's got competition.
Here comes
the piano solo.
Oh,
who's this?
Not just any piano solo, Robin. We're talking now of one of my all-time favorites, one of the under-recognized major figures, Wynton Kelly. And he's part of the rhythm section here. Wynton Kelly, Paul Chambers, bass, Jimmy Cobb, drums. To me, Wynton Kelly, in his non-ballad style, always suggested a kid skipping home on the last day of school. When I hear this, I think of Wynton Kelly telling the sleeping Snow White, hey, wake up, we're going to have a really great time.
Okay, well, the final soloist, final competition, right,
yeah.
is coming up next.
Yeah, it's the great tenor saxophonist John Coltrane, and the year before they made this record, Coltrane had left Miles to form his own band, and he was just coming into his own as a leader when Someday My Prince Will Come was done. He'd never played this song before.
Okay.
So what does he do but unleash one of the most incredibly impassioned lyrical solos of anyone's career, not just Coltrane's.
As a suitor?
Well, he's head over heels in love. I mean, he's putting it all out there. Coltrane's been around, so he knows that, you know, maybe this isn't the wisest course of action, but, you know, it doesn't matter. He wants the world to know, and if Coltrane's sound doesn't break the spell that's been put on Snow White, well, the Queen's powers are much more evil than I thought.
I'm realizing, too, as I listen to this, that this is a whole new group of guys. You know, she had the seven dwarfs, but in this song
right.
We have the whole, you know, each has a different personality.
Good
and
one.
And Miles brings things to an end.
Yeah, he restates the theme, and then we go out on some Wynton Kelly ascending chords. But I love the way that Miles really brings things to the end.
The legendary Miles Davis's version of Someday My Prince Will Come as deconstructed by Here Now's jazz aficionado, James Isaacs.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.